isn't it?
I don't know how true it is, or if there's just a little speaker here that's just feeding into my ear anyway. I'm not sure if I've just paid 100 quid.
That's it. The lying about some miracle solution, where in fact it's just another speaker sticking audio into your ear. So yes, who knows. Anyway, we're live, everybody. We're live, and I'm delighted to be bringing to you another Founders Focus. This has rapidly become the favorite thing for me to do, because it's so interesting to be speaking to people who have been so annoyed at recruiting that they thought it would be a good idea to set up a company to try and solve that particular problem. Most of us just moan about it and just get on with the next day. But I'm speaking to people that think, right, I've had it. I'm going to try and fix this and do something about it. And so I'm delighted to continue this series. We're episode 20. And we're with a guy I actually spoke to years ago, 3-4 years ago now, and it's just been amazing to see the journey he and his team has been on. It's Ryan McCabe from Odro. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Hung. I think it might be longer than 4 years, by the way.
Don't say that, mate. I'm looking at the gray in my beard and I'm thinking, I don't need time to accelerate with the speed that it is, you know what I'm saying?
No, that's why I shave all mine off, because it's changing colour. No, it was in-house recruitment expo, I think, about 5 years ago. I was trying to check back.
Yeah, long time ago. So, Ryan, I mean, what's awesome about where you're at now is that I'm starting to get like random calls from people, and they're using Odro technology. And I'm thinking that's a good sign. You know what I mean? There's like no connection, but people are using it just to have this conversation. And whenever I speak to anybody in the recruiting space, you know, certainly people on the, you're there. You know, there's no question that people understand this product does that and it's in this market. So wonderful to see your progress. Before we kick off, Ryan, just give us a quick overview. For the very few recruiters that don't know what Odro is, how would you describe it? How would you give us a two-liner on this?
So we used to be video interviewing 4 years ago, but we've come on a long way since then. We've developed a lot of different video technology, but our mission now is to humanize the recruitment process at scale. That's what we do. So we do it by creating incredible connections at every stage of the hiring process.
Yeah, and the video is still core though, isn't it? It's still one of the earliest entry point where people understand the product is through using it to change, I guess, how, you know, early conversations happen and early connections happen.
Yeah, video's always been it's been the core part of what we do. I think what we're realizing is that there's, you know, it's all about creating that connection. And if there's other ways to do that, then we want to explore them. But right now it's just 100% video, man. Like it's just so much easier to do.
Yeah. Excellent. You're a busy man, Ryan. And what did you have to cancel in order to come on to Founders Focus today?
I don't know. No, I'd cancel anything for you, Hung. Absolutely anything.
And every CEO says this. Every CEO that I've had says, I'm not doing anything. Maybe lunch. It's like, come on, mate. It's supposed to be really hard to run a startup, yeah? It's meant to be really difficult. So let's start 21. With that. You don't look it, mate. Let's start with that, Ryan. Having embraced the role of the founder and chief decision maker, the person that's trying to build this thing, what has been like the major compromise you've had to make in your life in order to make this happen?
Major compromise in my life. I spend a lot of time on Odro. I know that's the obvious answer, but I don't really see it as compromise. I love what I do. And to the point where if I probably wasn't paid for it, I would do it anyway. I've done it since I was young, since I was a kid. I was printing fake bus passes and selling them to other kids in the playground. Like, that's another story. But I've always done stuff like that. So enterprise and business has always interested me. So I don't see it as a compromise, although my wife might disagree. So I've got a very firm rule, though. I don't miss birthdays or, you know, kids' sporting events. I don't miss any of that. So I never put work before that. But the odd Saturday early... very early morning this morning, for example, was in here for 5:30, my first call. That's not every day. But so I'm very fluid with that sort of stuff. So in terms of compromise, yes, you could say time, but I don't really see it as that. It's just a necessary ingredient to growing a business.
Maybe that's the key, Ryan, where you've got some hard points that you don't compromise on. So instead of having a situation where basically it's completely loose and you know, like it can absolutely consume you in a negative way, what you're saying is, look, there's simple things that sit at the have to happen irrespective of what goes on with business. Not going to miss these important family things, not going to miss the commitments I've got to family and to friends. Other than that, you're going to flex around because you do have to work hard to do what you do. You know, it's not an easy thing to try and create a business and to grow it. So, but maybe that's a lesson to entrepreneurs out there who, you know, sometimes I'm one of these like overworkers. I would like throw every single thing at it. And actually, that's not a healthy thing because you'll burn yourself out. What you need is to have some stopper. And you know, having those fixed points are going to be one of those things that will help you do it. Let's rewind back in time, Ryan. You mentioned that you've always had this entrepreneurial vibe. I can totally see the picture of you being the kid who's, you know, in the tuck shop, like, you know, making 2p margin off the Mars bars or whatever it is. But has that always been a thing? Like, did you always know you're going to be an entrepreneur, or was there a moment where it flicked onto you that you thought, right, I'm going to do this now?
I feel like I've always done it for as long as I can remember. I don't remember when I was 2, 3, 4. I remember, though, with me and a couple of friends chapping the doors to wash neighbours' cars, for example. I remember trying to cart a big bag of bakery stuff from my papa's bakery to try and sell them round the doors. Like, I've always wanted to do that. I was a DJ from when I was 15 on my own, doing parties and things. But I'm quite lucky. So in my family, if you wanted to do something, you did it yourself. So I call him my papa, but my mum's dad, my granddad, whatever, my papa, he worked for Greggs, the baker, and he realised that if he was worth £10 a week to Greggs, he's worth £20 a week to himself. He always said that. So he's had his own bakery for nearly 60 years now, I think. My dad worked for an electrical company and started working for himself when I was about 15, 16. So I saw that happen. My uncle ran pubs. My aunt ran knitting shops. So it was very much a case of, I just saw that happen around me. So I'm quite lucky that way, where I just saw, you know, hard work.
That's very interesting that you've had that exposure to entrepreneurial spirit, because there are people out there that never consider it. Certainly myself. I mean, I was very much down, okay, academic route, go to university, graduate scheme, get some corporate job, doesn't matter what, you know, end up somewhere
on the ladder,
end up somewhere middle class comfortable, right? That's basically what I was on a track until my life changed in a different way. But it seemed in your case, because of the exposure you had, it seemed that every significant figure in your family had some sort of thing going on. Maybe that inculcated something. Do you think that's genetic? Do you think you were born that way, or do you think it was a learned thing?
I don't know. It definitely was. If it wasn't born, I mean, it was, even if I was born with it, it was certainly honed because of what I was surrounded with. So I don't think if I was born with it and wasn't surrounded by it, that I would be in the same position I am now. I feel like it was, if it was in me, it was definitely grown by watching what was going on around about me.
Yeah. And you know what an education that is, because you're learning business at that very early age. In you know, when you're a kid, it's kind of gray market type of stuff. It's all right to kind of do illegal stuff when you're a kid. It's weird. like you can't possibly go and like sell foodstuffs as an adult. You know, you need a health certificate, you need all this type of stuff. But as a kid, you can totally get away with that. So this is a brilliant training without any regulation in order to how to run a business and seeing whether you're up for it and the extra hustle that you need to do. And of course, you do get rewards quite quickly, don't you? Like, you can make a lot more money relatively than the other kids in school, and suddenly you can, you know, there's good stuff that comes with that, you know?
Yeah, well, I used to, like, that's, and it's funny because you can get away with stuff. So my gran had a double VCR player. So you could play one video and then you could record on the other one. So if there was something on, like, wrestling was really big when I was in school. So the wrestling would be on at 2 a.m. I would record it. You didn't have Sky Plus or YouTube or anything back then. So I would record the WrestleMania and then copy it 5 or 6 times, go to school, sell the videos, and just make money that way. And again, you got, I'm just laughing now, you got away with that. That was just...
And so early piracy was your training ground for running business. But at the same time, great, great entrepreneurial hustle. It reminds me of like the, you know, the pre, even the pre Spotify days, the pre iTunes days, when like I had a CD ripper. So I could download the tracks onto a computer and I could, you know, make CDs.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, sure. I was doing that. And in a strange way, It firstly makes you obviously pittance these days, but it makes you at that time some easy money that was quite cheap.
Good money,
but it also educated you in terms of things like supply and demand, and you know, marketing. Like, how do you actually broadcast this, and networking and stuff like this? So you learn like a lot of like really cool skills that you know probably we don't have the opportunity to do. It basically means when technology is out there and changes, that makes opportunity happen. So let's bring it to when you realize that technology would give Odro an opportunity. When did that moment happen, Ryan?
Well, I mean, the Odro story is slightly different to the standard story. This wasn't a, you know, I was in my garage and said, oh, this is what we're going to do, and then recruited people. I met a guy called Bill, who was my business partner for 5-6 years. And Bill had already started Odro. It was still him in his dining room, as he says, in his dining room with his slippers on. But he was coming up with a business to serve the legal sector. And when I met him, he was trying to get it off the ground. And I was just chatting to him about how to get a business off the ground. At that time, I was a recruiter. I had a small recruitment firm. And when we had these chats, he showed me this video technology that he had for legal firms. And he showed me how you just click a button and it opened and you were online. No downloads, no passwords, no PIN codes. And I was like, this was in the days of Skype and WebEx, and there was no FaceTime or anything like that. I was like, hold on, this is mega. And anyway, yeah, he said, oh, you just hit this button and you can record. And I was like, you can record with this thing. So there was this very light piece of technology that Bill had employed. We'd found a contractor called Mark who had built this on the fly. And cut a long story very short, I met with Bill and Mark and said, I'm going to go and quit my agency business. I had a business partner at the time. I'll quit my agency business. We'll go in and do this. And we'll split it three ways. We'll chuck in whatever money we have, which was very, very little. And then we'll give it a go. So that was the part where I realized the tech was already there. I mean, you couldn't store recordings. You couldn't do anything with it apart from get online. So it wasn't a completely, you know, profitable, scalable product, but I had something to go at, which is maybe slightly different from other people. So I knew at that point I couldn't do the business that I wanted to do without scalable technology. And that was the solution to say, hold on, this could really work in recruitment.
That's really, again, that tells me about your entrepreneurial eye. In Chinese, we call it like eye shine. Like you have the ability to just, you've got a bright eye, in other words. So you can see an opportunity and, you know, wow, that's going to be, there's an opportunity to exploit it there. Whereas maybe, you know, the previous, don't get me wrong, I mean, full respect to the legal sector, but I would imagine like building software for that group is going to be like mega, mega hard.
I mean, that's just 2015. Like, most people hated video calls at the best of times. And even when you got online, it would cut off. It wasn't, you know, even like 4G wasn't a thing. Just to go back, to, it's easy to say, oh, 2015. But the world was different only 7 years ago. So at that point, it was really difficult to get going. And I think whether it was a good or bad product for the legal sector, it was bad timing. Categorically, it was too early for that sector. Some would say it still is.
You know what? Interesting that you had to make a compromise because you sacrificed your business to do it. That tells me that's a really difficult decision to make, isn't it? Because if you've got a, you know, recruitment business, it can be good or bad, you know, but you know how the mechanics works. You also know how to make money. You know, it's one of those where once you've figured out your rhythm, pretty much you can go ahead and crack on. So how difficult was that for you to let that go? Talk us through that decision, Ryan.
So it was actually easier than you would think. I wasn't happy. That's the bottom line. I wasn't happy. I was driving a car I couldn't afford. I was trying to be the big man in every meeting I went into, pretending I had more than I actually had. It was all very bravado, and I just wasn't comfortable with it at all. And I was kind of stuck in this cycle. So I wanted something else. And my initial thought was to try and turn around what we had. But I was falling out with my business partner at the time, and it wasn't really working for me. So I was in that state of flux anyway. And it was stressful. I was a bad recruiter. When I was in recruitment, I wasn't very good. It was hand to mouth. It was 25th of the month. We need to get money in to pay the wages. It was that sort of inexperience, you know, that was causing me that unhappiness. But recurring revenue in a software business can stop that happening. And that was for me to say, well, that would make me happier. It's a tech company, so I could wear a hoodie rather than a three-piece suit if I really wanted to, and I would get away with it. And again, this was 2015. This wasn't widespread. I mean, I remember putting a pair of jeans on in 2015 and thinking, oh, am I allowed to do this? Am I going to get away with this? I'm going to a meeting with a pair of jeans on. But that allowed me to just be a bit happier that it was me. It wasn't the work Ryan version I was having to pretend or act. It was me. And I read this the Japanese proverb, actually, about the three masks. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
So I love it. And to be fair, if the team watch this back, they'll go, oh, here he goes again with his three masks. But it's true. And I really believe in it. So the Japanese believe that you have three masks. The first mask is the mask you wear to the world. So anyone that you meet, they see this version of you by this mask that you wear. You have a second mask that your spouse, maybe your really close friends see. That's the version of you that they know. And then you've got the third mask, which only you know. So all that stuff you got up to, Hung, that's that mask. That's that one that no one else knows. And the Japanese believe that the closer those three masks are aligned, the happier you are. And I totally resonated with me. And I thought, you know what? This is the chance to kind of quit that and just go out and just do what I want to do and not pretend. And that's the way I've been ever since. It's been the best thing I've ever done.
You know what? That's just a really great story, Ryan, and also a really good proverb as well. It is so true, because if you have big gaps between those masks, it means you're putting a lot of mental and emotional energy maintaining those identities. And it's exhausting. It's absolutely exhausting to try and be a different person than you intuitively are. Now, obviously, you should make the best of yourself. You shouldn't just accept your bad habits and say, oh, this is who you are. You should always strive to improve. But if there's a huge distance between your projection and the reality, that's not a sustainable way to maintain things. That's a very... Have you ever read the book, The Picture of Dorian Gray? Is that
I've heard of that, though.
It was a play by Oscar Wilde, but it taps onto this exact idea. And just again, to summarize the story real quick, basically, there was this guy called Dorian Gray, and he had a picture of himself, like it was a painting. And the painting was the thing that basically absorbed all of his sins, right? So he was a preternaturally young guy, similar to us here, you know, immune to age. All of his terrible things he got up to, the mass that the painting would absorb. So he was two different people. It was basically a metaphor for the guy's soul, essentially, because he was doing all of these things. It wasn't visible externally, but it was massively injuring his spirit, essentially, until the end of the story, which is a very famous story, so hopefully there's no spoilers. But at the end, he destroys the picture and he dies because he wants to not have this terrible soul anymore. So I think, yes, you need to understand who you are as a person and just lean very heavily into that. There is a career path and there is a job or there is a business that you can run being who you are. And that is the way. That is the way to for sustainable happiness is maybe a way you can put it.
Well, you mentioned before about, you know, like working so long and, you know, you could potentially burn yourself out if you overwork. But if you're just being yourself and doing something that you enjoy doing, you don't burn out. Well, sorry, I've found that I don't burn out, because as much as there's bad days, right? Don't get me wrong. There's some days that I'm banging my head against the wall, but on the whole, I really enjoy what I do and who I spend my time with as well. It's about people. And that was the big part for me, talking about those masks.
Yeah.
I don't have to pretend to be someone else. I create better relationships with people because I'd like to think that when someone speaks to me, they know that actually it's not an act. I'm not trying to pretend to be a big CEO or, you know, pretend that I've got some hidden agenda. Mm-hmm. I just try my best. I'm sure I'll make mistakes along the way, but I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying my best to just be one version of myself.
That's it. And to be honest with you, this day and age, we are very much into the idea of needing to be transparent and needing to be open. And all of these terms kind of maybe now getting to the point where they're being overused. But I think, you know, the idea of like presenting a polished image of how the business is or how you are, people reject it because they know it's false. Yeah. And it's not a case of keeping up with the Joneses in that way. It's just being honest as to who you're at. The only sort of journey that you're on is that, you know, you're the only person that can ever be on this journey. So this is it. You know, you got to just show it. Ryan, as a CEO, obviously as a CEO philosopher, you must have thought about this. Like, have you reviewed your own CEOing and then looked at it and think, right, I'm really quite good at this part of the job and actually not so good at this. Like, can you identify elements of the job of the CEO that you think are your strengths, and which ones are the ones that you think you're not so good at?
Yes. So start with things I'm not so good at. People are really good operationally at, you know, writing a thorough plan, think of every angle that could go wrong, every risk, all that stuff, write it down, set milestones, timelines, and then constantly check KPIs and metrics against that milestone. And I'm not very good at that. I'm good at it for a couple of weeks, but then after that, I'm on to the next thing. And that's always been, you know, a kind of flaw of mine, if you like, and I was able to surround myself with good people that can plug that gap. So that's how I've solved that problem. So I have great people around about me on the board. I have great people on the leadership team that I've been very transparent that that is a gap of mine, but hopefully make up for it in other ways. So that's been a big, that's a kind of flaw of mine. That's for a weakness that I work on.
Can I just sit on that for a little while, Ryan? Like, how did you, was that obvious from the beginning, or was that something that you had to understand over time? And at what point did you realize you needed to get someone else to kind of support on that area and take a little bit away from you?
It was probably obvious to other people at the time. It wasn't obvious to me. I wasn't that self-reflective. Bear in mind, when we started Odro, I was 25. And I didn't know a lot about a lot. But you think you do when you're 25. So it probably took me... I skinned my knees a few times to learn that. And I was quite lucky because I was probably the king of winging it when I was younger, if I'm being totally honest. I was able to wing my way through situations, probably because communication is one of my strengths and I can connect with someone. So, I probably got away with it longer than I should have, to be honest. But maybe 4 years ago, I realized if I don't plug this gap, we won't go any further. We're just going to keep making mistakes and losing things along the way. So you plug that gap with people, and you realize that I'm going to give you loads of philosophy now. If you want to go far, go together. But if you want to go quickly, go alone. A little bit ruined. I think I realized very early on that you kind of lean into your strengths and make them better and then play with them. Or you could try and be the best at everything. I just didn't have the time to do that.
Oh, hey, Ryan, I think we're having some internet issues here. So the sound quality, I think, is degraded, and also the video seems to be struggling. Just to let you know, I wonder whether there's a way you can switch to, I don't know, maybe a 4G or something, if there's a problem there.
I'm hardwired, so it should be okay. But
really?
I'll just... Okay. Yeah, it's okay. Maybe there's a connection. Let me tell. Might come back. I might nick away just now. If you just bear with me a second.
Yeah.
This is a good test for the 5G element of my phone.
Yeah. I'm blaming the weather, you know. I don't know whether it's. I was going to say, I don't know whether it's wet up where in where you are, but it's Glasgow, so obviously it is wet.
Always wet.
But in Yeah, yeah. So I'm blaming the sodden internet cables.
Yeah, it's fine. Sorry, I'm trying to get this working now, but for some reason it's not letting me connect over there in a
second.
That's
okay. We can hear you okay. So whilst you're trying with that, then we can keep talking, and hopefully the video will come back to us. So tell us a little bit about the things that you kind of do well. You mentioned communication was one of your strengths. I think people who know you would definitely say that was true. Where do you think that helps as a CEO in particular?
Communicating where the company is going, for a start. I think that everyone needs to know where we're all heading towards. And I don't think that, I mean, I've not been great at that, you know, consistently. I've went through peaks and troughs, if you like, of being good at communicating that vision and that goal. But just in general, if you are focusing on your communication, it's not just about how you relay your message. It's how you allow people to open up enough that they can relay theirs. So if they can have a call, if you make it a safe space for them to tell you things that they maybe didn't feel comfortable telling you before, you can move a lot quicker. So yeah, I feel like by being, I'm not going back to three masks, but being authentic is a big part of that. If you're vulnerable and you are very truthful and transparent about what is happening and what is going to happen, then I feel like that's there's an opportunity there for someone else to kind of do the same.
How do you maintain the company culture as it grows, Ryan? Because as the CEO, as you're growing the business, you are the custodian of the culture, of this culture of transparency and what have you. How do you make sure? I think it's kind of one of those things that gets worse or more difficult as you grow in size, isn't it? Because you're going to end up having more people. Maybe it's now distributed across different places. Maybe you've got another tier of managers managing them, so there's some distance between you and the people that are coming on. How do you make sure that, you know, the Odd Draw culture stays and grows the way in which you want it to grow?
It's hard. We've not got it right all the time. So, you know, we make mistakes and then you go, oh, I don't like that. That's not the right behavior. You know, we need to fix that. So it's not linear. And I feel like anyone who I know and maybe I admire or aspire to build a similar business to, they've all told me that you go through peaks and troughs. It goes really well. Culture drops off, bad hire, you know, disappointing performance over a sustained period. Something like that kind of changes the vibe. You know, people leaving for, you know, other things could, or people staying when they shouldn't stay. You know, all this sort of stuff just plays into it. So I believe that culture is something that evolves over time. One of the things I've learned is that it's detrimental to try and hold on to the one culture because it starts to shape who you look for. I mean, culture fit, if you're hiring for culture fit, I believe that is one straight way to hire the same type of people all the time, and it locks out diversity potentially. So I feel like it's something that has to evolve. A few core pillars. Ours are, you know, authenticity, energy, trust, and then we've got a behavior wheel that sort of underpins all that. But I believe that it's difficult is the short answer to the question,
and
it's the long answer is,
and it's also uncomfortable, right? So it's almost like, as you say, hiring for cultural fit is actually the most comfortable thing to do because you can predict, oh, I'll hire Ryan, I like Ryan, he likes me, it's fine, it's going to be great. But if that's how you do it, then you can understand how that over time will might ossify into a certain type of business that isn't necessarily the most competitive business out there. When you're hiring someone whose, you know, behaviors might be a little bit challenging, let's say, or, you know, whose approach is slightly different, but you can still see potentially could help us move to the next stage, that may not necessarily be a comfortable hire. It's a challenging hire, but it might still be the right one to make.
Yeah, and we've got, like, that's the thing as well, like building a business, you just make mistakes a lot. I was actually saying this to my wife a couple of weeks ago. The job isn't to not make mistakes. The job is not to make any wrong or bad decisions. The job is to make more good decisions than bad ones. And it's just inevitable that has to be the way it is. So, but hiring decisions are a big part of that. So, and one of our key hires recently was a head of learning and development. And there's only around 50 of us. So that's an early, that's, you know, we're a small company to have a head of L&D and a pretty senior one at that. But that for me was an investment in the culture and the driving towards the same goal together and making sure that, you know, we take everyone with us on that journey rather than, you know, using people to get to the next stage, if you like, which I've seen some companies do and I don't like it.
Yeah, I totally get what you're saying. And also, again, the attitude of being resilient to mistakes is another key component of entrepreneurship, in my opinion, that's underrated. It's not about making no errors. It's about being able to, firstly, not make like completely definitive screw-ups. That's a different story. Yeah. Like be able to recover from these mistakes, but have position yourself to always be able to make a little experiments. You've always got to be able, and experiments is another way to say gambling, you know, a little bit of a roll of dice, see what happens. Your job as an entrepreneur is to make sure you keep your ability to keep making these experiments and not have them, you know, end the story for you or your business. Go ahead, Ron.
There's an analogy that Amazon use, and it's one door and two door decisions.
Okay.
So a two-door decision is one that you can undo, if you like. So for example, if we change the logo to red and it didn't work, then we can change it back to blue and it's not really going to make that much of a difference. So that's worth a punt. But if we decided to, I don't know, make Odro self-service on the website and give everyone, you know, unlimited access if they signed up today, that's a one-door decision. Like you could sink the whole commercial strategy and not be able to dial that back easily. That's a one-door decision. So the methodology they follow is how do we turn one-door decisions into two-door decisions? And it's usually down to pulling a lever on the scope, the time, the availability of that decision as a test pilot. So that's in my head quite a lot when we go to make decisions. Is it a two-door decision?
Is there ever a situation where a one-door decision is the right decision to go for?
Yes, absolutely.
Can you think of when that decision has been made? Have you made one of those decisions during the course of Odro?
I mean, the very start, the first one-door decision we made was in 2015, when me, Bill and Mark got together, we sold Odro as a video calling system to accountants, lawyers, recruitment firms, the NHS. I mean, we had, I can't remember how many people, but it was thousands of people on a pilot to use Odro for doctor's appointments way before all of this COVID stuff. This was in 2016. So we did all that. And the one door decision was to reject all that business on one day and say, we don't do this anymore. We do recruitment. And the reason we don't do it is because we're not good at this, this, and this, but we're good at this, this, and this. And that's why we're going to recruitment. That was a one door decision. We'd set our stall out, we only serve recruitment, and that's built our whole brand. I mean, that switch was left on. The longer that switch is left on, the more irrecoverable that decision becomes, and it's been the best decision we ever made.
Talk us through that decision, Ryan. Like, how did it come to pass that how did it emerge to a point where that decision was something you guys had to make? I'm interested to know how that happened.
So you try and be all things to all people, never works. And I know everyone says it, but when you are a bootstrapped startup business that, I mean, I never took wages for 3-4 months. My wife was 7 months pregnant. So literally when we started this, my wife was pregnant with my first child. We didn't really know what was going on. I didn't have money to put in. I put a credit card into Odro. Like it was just go, right, let's just get it going, see what happens. And that is a difficult place to be. To be there and say no to revenue, because that was what was, you know, paying our wages. But I realized that I spent, I'm arbitrary figures, but of my 5-6 days a week, I spent 3 or 4 of them speaking to people who were never going to buy it. And if they did buy it, they were going to pay less than someone else, because the value to them was much less than the value to a recruiter. I knew someone who worked at a call center. And they were a lead generation company. And the difference between them and any other lead generation company is that they would record the phone call that the appointment was set on. So the proof of saying, trust me, it's worthwhile turning up to this, that was backed up by giving that recording. And that was where the idea came from to say, hold on, I'm in recruitment and I'm sending over CVs. If I sent over the recorded interview, then they know this person's worthwhile meeting. So that was the kind of click. And people would pay £10 for that or 50 pence for a Skype replacement. So that was where the value came. Hold on, the accountant doesn't care about recording the meeting, but the recruiter does, and they need specific features. They want one-way interviews, talent shortlists at a time, talent dashboards. We had to pick a lane if we were going to survive for a long time. And it was a scary decision, but a very conscious one, and one of our better ones.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love this. I love your ability at the time to just understand that the trust factor was the reason why people would pay more. This is, I think, when I first encountered Odro, was essentially you're providing proof of work, essentially.
On a contingent payment model, that was the thing that was elusive. I mean, and I was speaking from someone who was in that position and saying, yes, you'll give me £8,000 for that role. And they would go, I'm giving you £8,000 for a CV. And I had no way of proving otherwise.
Yeah, so, and that's still a bugbear, but in recruiting, it's like, you've just emailed me a CV, I've paid you this amount of money, I'm being ripped off. And that's because they can't see the value that you've put in. And actually, you can't validate the work that you've done, because you might well have just sent that CV in, right? It's perfectly possible that you've made that money off one email send. And I'm sure that's how a lot of recruiters do make money. But the original Odro was to say, look, what I'm going to do is send the CV, but I'm also going to send you evidence of the conversation I've had with the candidate, as well as you can see also the assessment. You can then validate my assessment with your own assessment by watching or listening to that video interview. And that basically changed the direction of Odro into, you know, where you guys are at now. So that's a fascinating, fascinating story. So it's interesting, as you say, I think everyone has one door, two door decisions, whether you're an entrepreneur or not. We're all entrepreneurs of our own lives. And probably it's a good rule of thumb to have as many two door decisions as possible. But now and again, you need to be brave enough to say, to shut one of those doors and to say, I'm going straight through this, and there's no other way back. Yeah, absolutely fascinating. So maybe it takes a bit of courage as well, right? I mean, fortune does favor the brave, and we need to find a way to cultivate the courage muscle, if you like, in decisions that we make. Okay, let's talk about sort of Glasgow. Because suddenly Glasgow is like full of these like recruiting tech businesses. Like, how did this happen? give us some chat about this.
I mean, to be fair, there's a few just popping up, which is great. And I mean, I'll be honest, there's not a massive community around it. It's just a kind of common thing that we all know that we're all up here, but there's not really a kind of group for me. Maybe there should be, or maybe there is and I'm not in it. But also happened before. I think it's great to see. Edinburgh was always the place in Scotland where innovation was born, right? It was, you know, and when I was just getting started, every other tech startup that was at the similar stage to me was in Edinburgh, bar one or two. So all the dinners were in Edinburgh, the events, the awards, the fundraising events, all that sort of stuff. So I love to see it. There's a place called Code Clan, which has started, you know, training software developers. And even things like, in our early days, and Code Clan wasn't that big back then, but Code Clan would bring in people from other professions, like a school teacher who decided, I don't want to be a school teacher anymore, I want to write code. And they would go through this 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 month course. We actually partnered with them very early stages. We didn't have a software tester in the early stages. So we phoned up Code Clan, guy Adam, who was great to us back then. I said, look, why don't we bring all of Code Clan into our office? We'll give them our system. First person to break it wins, give them £50, whatever it was, but we'll buy in pizza and beers and we'll talk tech with them. And that's how we tested our system for the first year. And in return, we would give everyone a kind of letter of recommendation that they took part in it, and hopefully some detailed feedback in some cases about how good they were, you know, a bit of commendation. And that was brilliant. But anyway, that was the kind of the beginnings that I saw of a real tech ecosystem in Glasgow. But I can't profess to be a big part of it right now. I've got three kids at home, so as soon as I'm out of Audra, I'm straight home.
No. It's great to see these startups emerge from different places. Like, one of the things that we do need to see is, everything can't come out of London or can't come out of Edinburgh or whatnot. We need to see a lot more distribution. I think it actually gives people hope. If you're a young Glaswegian entrepreneur right now and you're looking up at people like yourself and, you know, Adam Gordon's of this world and, Adam, those types of folks, they're going to think, hang on, this can happen, and it can happen here. I don't need to up sticks and go someplace. You can create great businesses in anywhere, as long as you have the motivation and the effort to do it. So yeah, great to see things happening in Glasgow. Talk to me about where you think recruitment is right now. So you started Audra pre-COVID. Right now we're still kind of in, I don't know what stage of the pandemic we're at right now, but how has sort of your software impacted, how has COVID, I guess, impacted the growth of your business? And where do you think technology sits for recruitment agencies right now?
So for agencies in particular, I think it's an interesting time because there's, massive candidate shortage. Everyone knows there's a massive fight for, whether it's salaries, great resignation, it's just a little bit chaotic right now. And we don't know how long it's going to last. All we do know is it can't last forever. It's unsustainable. It's a kind of upward spiral of salary, for example. And I feel like from an agency perspective, there are higher demands on what they should be doing for the customers. If they're being paid these high fees, then they should be given a high quality of service. And that's maybe doing a little bit more than they should have, than they have been doing and potentially should have done. From an in-house recruitment perspective, which is a big part of our strategy moving forward to support in-house recruiters, it's about understanding that it's a candidate-led market and changing your interview process to suit that so that you don't miss out on talent. So I know that's obvious. Your audience are going to be well on top of that. But for me, I feel like hiring managers need to be educated on just how serious it is and how difficult and competitive it is to even get the candidates, the good candidates, in the door in the first place. And I'm speaking as a hiring manager. We're hiring for a VP of sales right now. And the recruiter that I'm working with, he said, what's your interview process? So I said, well, they'll meet with me, then they'll meet with Dave, then it's psychometric, and then they meet us as a panel, if you like, and we go through the final stage. And he said, no, the first stage is you pitch the role to them. And I was kind of, initially, emotionally, I was like, no, I don't. And then within minutes, I realized, but I'm like, of course it is, because if they are good at what they do, we need to tell them why this is a good move for them. So as a hiring manager, I feel as if I'm quite forward thinking with that stuff. But if I needed to be educated on that, I feel like it's something that, needs to be shouted about more.
That's a really important point, because when you said sort of educate hiring managers, I initially was thinking, hiring managers, you've got to be quicker, you've got to be quicker decision-making, etc. Yes, all of that. But actually, hiring managers now need to understand their primary job is less about assessment and more about sales. Like, you have to really present, why should this person want to work for your business, and in fact for you as a manager of this person? Like, how are you going to support this person grow their career and help them hit their objectives and do all of that type of stuff? So
on that part, Hung, one of the things, and again, and I mentioned before, we used to do, it was just video interviewing and then video messaging, but we realized this market right now needs the hiring managers to sell the position and sell themselves as a leader. So we now work with hiring managers and corporate recruitment outfits to get online with the hiring manager through Audra, record a short interview with the hiring manager saying, why do you work there? What's your leadership style like? Why are you looking for this person? And it's a 3 to 5 minute video, subtitles and logos and stuff on it. But that saves them having to do that at the time to that extent. It managed to sell the role and the leader en masse, which and that's humanizing it at scale.
And that's just a scalable thing to do, isn't it? I remember a good friend of mine, Ben Gledhill, who does it like literally with consumer level tech. I think, you know, he's a TA, head of TA, and he will insist to the hiring manager, look, get your phone out. And I need 30 seconds from you to tell us about the job. Because what I'm going to do is send that to a candidate I qualify, or one of my team qualifies, and say, look, here's the boss telling you why he's growing this position, why he's growing his team and hiring for this position. And I just think, you know what, that's 30 seconds worth of effort. But it is so impactful because, again, it's a trust builder for the candidate. The candidate is seeing this person who they would never interact with in any way until at the end of the process, but they're seeing him right up front and saying, look, hear it from the horse's mouth. This is what the boss is saying. This is what you can look forward to as you go forward. And I think that should be a mandatory. We should move to the point where this is like, of course, every hiring manager should be doing this.
And do you know, one of the things, and it's a good exercise to go through, if you ask someone, what is the USP? What is the value prop for this position? Why would you work at your business? 8 times out of 10, first thing they say is the people and the culture. It's the people and the culture. And yet you have to wait 2 weeks before you speak to the people about the culture. Why are we not taking the big selling point and putting it at the front of the process? And that was the kind of impetus for us to say, we need to build a product to do this.
Yeah, and this, they're talking about that. This is where you're kind of have added more, like increased the scope of the product from being initially a recorded video interview. So stage one of Odro was, we're going to record a video interview with candidate and then have that dispatchable to a hiring manager. Tell us a little bit more about this, the video message. Tell us about these other sort of things that Odro customers are now using and can expect in 2022.
So everything that we do is again based on humanizing the recruitment process at scale. So the way we did it before was very much you would record a video for every candidate, and that works in some high, kind of high level, low volume scenarios. It's not scalable. So we wanted to work out a way that we can put the human from the business at the front of the process and throughout. So we created something called the Incredible Connections Framework. And that maps the whole recruitment process and looks at every stage. So, from job advertisement, proactive candidate searching through to first and second stage interview, we look at candidate experience as a whole and how do we keep that incredible connection between the people at the company, the brand, and the candidate. So there's videos, automated video responses on job adverts to make sure that you get a person in front of that candidate before anyone else and create a connection. We have, pre-interview videos where the candidate drop-off rate reduces quite substantially. So for example, first stage screening interviews with one of our customers had an 18% drop-off rate. And by sending a pre-recorded video outlining what the interview would entail from the person who was going to conduct it and what the process looked like after that, we reduced the drop-off rates down to 2%. And all we changed was give them an intro from the person they're going to be meeting, telling them what to expect. That's it. And through the framework, there's actually 17 opportunities through video or otherwise.
Where is this framework? Is this a public framework?
It's locked in a box, isn't it? It's for customers only. No, we do talk about the framework. We do talk about the framework publicly a lot. Actually create bespoke frameworks for customers as well.
I think this could be a really good piece of content. I mean, let me know, folks, people who are watching this on LinkedIn, Crowdcast, wherever it is that you're watching it, would you be interested in this kind of framework to say, here are moments where there's a risk that the candidate feels as they're getting a dehumanized experience. And here's where actually you can upgrade it by putting something in as simple as a pre-recorded message. And I think the key component that you mentioned here is the message is from the person who's involved in the process.
It's so important.
It's not a stock actor. It's not the intern. It has to be. So the question on this would be, how do you get the commitment? So I can totally understand people looking at this and you maybe even customers of Odro And I think I ain't going to get my managers on this. Like, it's impossible. How have you advised companies to get that buy-in?
So we integrate with Microsoft Teams and Zoom. So what that means is you're already on the call. And if you just hit record, it automatically fires into Audro. So if I'm on this call with you now, I'm on Teams, and we're talking about the brief, for example, I'm taking the brief from you. I'm an internal TA, and I'm taking the brief to go and taking the rec to go and to get this role. I'm just going to say, look, I'm going to press record and I'm going to interview you right now for a couple of minutes, just to make sure I get as many candidates as possible. The problem before was if I sent you a link and said go and record a video on your phone, I'm putting the ball in your court. I'm in control. We're on Teams anyway. I didn't tell you this is why we're coming on. I told you we're coming on for the brief, which is true. But I have an opportunity now to get that recording so I can put it on the ad and I can use it to send to candidates. So it's just making it a frictionless process for the hiring manager is the key. I mean, there's other uses that are harder to do. So for example, before someone starts a role, a really, really nice touch is for the hiring manager or a colleague to send them a video to say, looking for a very personal video. Ben, looking forward to seeing you on Monday. You know, this is your desk. This is where you're going to be sitting. Like, anything you need, give me a shout. That's a hard step to add. That's a pro tip, right? You can't get it on every role. You wouldn't have to bank for every single person that starts to get that video because it's hard to scale. So there's levels of what you can and can't do depending on how amenable the hiring managers are.
But I think, you know, all of this is a journey we're all going on. But as you've described the onboard, that would be awesome to see that, wouldn't it? I mean, if you had your future colleagues show you what your desk was like, or, you know, just produce something of that type, so much better than just like relying on an email saying show up at this time, date, or whatever it might be. It's understanding that this is a potentially high stress situation. At least it's anxious. You know, the person is interacting with a bunch of people that know each other more than they know you. So this is a great way to try and build that relationship. So I can totally see what you mean by putting the humanity into these different features. And in fact, also then taking more care with this, the corporate marketplace, which is sounds like it's going to be a big part of the future for Audro going forward. Previously, you guys are very much agency focused, weren't you, 2-3 years ago. Now you see a corporate in-house as an additional sort of market for you.
Yeah, well, we were asked, we made a very clear decision to support staffing firms through this for years. And it was just to help us with our focus, marketing, training, onboarding, because it is very different. So we focused on that, but I mean, we're at 10,000 users, more than 10,000 users now. So for us, we now had clients that were saying, I really like this, and, you know, corporate hiring managers, I really like this, can I buy it? And for years we were saying no, all the time. And it got to a point where our customers were saying, look, our clients want a connected candidate experience, and we've got, you know, we're happy for you to do it. So can you please, in this occasion, work with us? I mean, that happened 7 times, 8 times, 9 times. And it was the only way we would do it was if it were introduced by the staffing firm. And it just became obvious that, you know, that exclusivity that we had to the staffing firms was on us, not on them. So we had to work out how do we connect that candidate experience and make it a benefit for everyone. And that's what we've been working on. And we've got some great stories, great case studies that you know, just supporting that candidate experience, no matter who you're dealing with, if it's a representative of your organization or the organization itself, I feel like it's really important to connect them.
Yeah. And like you say, the more the research that we do about how people feel about, you know, employer brand or the company culture, the more we realize it's less connected with the overall, like the corporate brand or the corporate culture, and more with the immediate people that you'd be working with. So it's your hiring manager, your key colleagues, the key interfaces you have across departments. They're the people that have the biggest impact on your well-being and your performance. So to be able to see them as you enter into a recruiting process, I think is the more I hear about it, the more obvious it is, and we'll probably we'll probably look back on the past, how we ever made sort of yes decisions without having that component. It's incredible. Like, well, we'd just go through a bunch of interviews and then say, yeah, sure, I'll join. And you have no idea. You have no idea who the people
who are joining.
So, yeah, exactly. Going in blind.
Well, that was the thing. The stat that sold it for me to completely pivot, to be quite frank, how our technology was implemented and used and built, was there's a stat that said 80% of candidates leave a bad manager, not necessarily a brand or job. And everyone's familiar with those rough stats. But there was no stats on how many candidates joined a good manager and they picked a role because of the manager. Mm. And everywhere I looked, it was a very big proportion of people who said, I want to work for that girl. I want to work for that guy. And that made me think, well, why are we not putting that as a selling point? Why is that not there? That was where the whole module and the framework was born.
Do you know what? That's such an interesting thought, because let's say you're a candidate and you're going through multiple processes with different companies. How decisive is the manager in each of those processes? I think they're massively decisive, isn't it?
I've seen this from a personal point of view, the people I work with are that's what makes it an enjoyable place. And everyone, whether that can be articulated or not, I believe that is a really strong factor in any decision, especially in today's world, if I'm being honest. But I just don't, look, our tagline is create incredible connections. It's what it's all about. Everything is born from the connection. So if I'm in five processes, the one I want the most, if everything's equal, the one I want the most is the one that I connected with. The person on the other end of the screen or the other end of the table, that's the one that's my favorite because I made a connection. I like them. I get a good feeling about it. That's humans that cause that feeling. So
yeah,
I feel like we should be putting them at the front of the process.
I forget the name. You talk about, as you're a philosopher CEO, Ryan, I forget the name of the philosopher that said, reason is the slave of the passions, right? So, which is the idea, we think that we are rational, calculating ROIs to this, that, the other, but really we only do that after the passion has already made a decision and we're rationalizing after the fact to justify what was always an intuitive decision, which doesn't mean it's a dumb decision. It just means that we're listening to different parts of data that we've picked up in a different way. The body language, the little micro expressions that you had when you're speaking to the manager, or the enthusiasm you got, all those like really hard to quantify, hard to collect and quantify data, is still data. Subliminally, we're making those types of decisions. Okay, so existing customers of Odro 2022, what can they expect in terms of product and stuff going down the pipe?
We've got a new release coming in a couple of weeks. I'll be honest, it was supposed to be Monday and a holiday kind of kicked that out in the development world. But we have a pretty big announcement on our video messaging to Odro Capture. It's a world's first. So no one else in the world can do this thing that we've managed to crack, which we're really proud of. But that's called Capture Pro, and that's launching within a couple of weeks. There are other things I can't talk through, but everything we do now is focused on humanizing the recruitment process. So we're talking about automation is a key part of what everyone's trying to do right now, but you can't over automate, right? And it can cause a poor candidate experience. So all I can say is that what we are working on now allows you to not lose that human touch through automation.
Yeah, very, very interesting, intriguing stuff. And the message to the people who aren't using Odro right now, and they're thinking, okay, we need to use technology in some way to improve efficiencies, but also to improve candidate experience. What kind of people generally would benefit most from Odro? Like, what kind of companies, what kind of roles, what kind of things would you say your product is optimized for?
Best way to say that is, here's a way to do it. Go apply for a job on your website and see how long it takes for you to see a person. See how long it takes for you to understand what the culture is like through the eyes of a candidate. And if that's any longer than 24, 48 hours, we can help you. I think that's the starting point. There's a lot of other ways that we can support, but if you go and apply for a role and you receive a faceless, we will come back to you if you're successful type of email, if there's no name there, if it's an info at, all that sort of stuff. We want to help you humanize that process. That's where it starts. But we focus on metrics and deliverables. So if you have candidate drop-off through the process, we want to look at if we can solve that for you. If you have low response rates from candidates, we can help you. If your time to hire is not where you want it to be, we can help you. But it's very focused on metric optimization for us. We wouldn't sell someone a product if it didn't solve a problem and we couldn't measure success criteria.
So, very, very good. Okay, well, Ryan, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you on your own journey and you know the continuing onward progress of this company. So we very much look forward to seeing how you and your team get on with things. What busy things do you now need to do for the rest of your day, Ryan? What's the next thing on the CEO agenda for you?
I need to prepare reports for the sales team. I need to speak to my head of CS about a couple of things. We're doing a voice of the customer in person. The first voice of the customer in person in London tomorrow. I can't make it. Or actually, I'll be honest. I can make it, but I've been told I'm not allowed to go because I get too involved and I want to fix every problem there and then. So
get Ryan told away from that meeting. He's not going to help.
True story. I've been told to stay away from so I don't try and solve things there and then. I've been told to stay away from that. So I'm going to tie in with them. And then, I'm trying not to stay too late because I need to go and see the kids tonight. So I'm going to make sure I get home in time for to help with dinner and stuff like that. So not a busy one.
Fantastic. Well, listen, Ryan, great speaking with you. Thank you so much for your time and thanks for joining Founders Focus. It's been a real pleasure having a chat with you, man.
Great to see you, Hung. Thanks again, man.
Wasn't he great? I love Ryan. He is a wonderful guy and a really interesting story from his own background. You can see, I think, what kind of entrepreneur he is. Anyway, if you're interested in what Odro do check them out, odro.co.uk. You can use them, I think, for their core, which is, you know, using video for recording candidate conversations, but also, as you can see, as an EB tool as well, as you're trying to improve candidate experience. So odro.co.uk. Okay, that's about it, everybody. If you enjoyed this type of series, make sure you follow the channel. We are back. I think we're doing these every Wednesday. So Founders Focus seems to be doing things on Wednesday. And we're doing Brain Food Live on Friday. So Brain Food Live this Friday is going to be when to post a job. Like, we're going to get some data for you to tell you exactly when job posting should take place. Make sure you join that if you want to optimize applicant flow. And next week, we've got a double header on Founders Focus. We're going to be speaking to Mark Chaffee, CEO of HackerJobs. And also later on in the day, tuning to US time, to Eamon Bartram, CEO of TripleByte. So make sure you join us for that. Okay, folks, thanks for watching. I'll see you next time.